to Resounds, Arts and Culture on the High Plains. I'm Corby Skinner.
And I'm Anna Page. And we're sharing stories of creative people who live and work in the Intermountain West.
Over the past two decades, Stephen Jimenez has spent extended periods of time in Wyoming researching, reporting, and writing about the Matthew Shepard tragedy. For his reporting on the case, he won a Writers Guild of America Award and an award for investigative reporting from Northwestern University School of Journalism.
Kirkus Reviews praised the book of Matt as fearless, frank, and compelling investigative journalism at its relentless and compassionate best.
Steve Jimenez is vice president of the UCross Foundation outside of Sheridan, Wyoming. He wrote a portion of the book while there in residency.
A new edition of Steve's The Book of Matt, the real story of the murder of Matthew Shepard, has just been released. It's a real honor to have you in the studio, Steve. Thanks for being here.
It's really a pleasure to be here.
And you've spent a good amount of time at UCross, several different residencies before you joined the board?
Yes. In fact, my history goes back 31 years. My first residency at UCross was in 1989, and it was my first time in Wyoming when I came in 89. And I just fell in love with Wyoming. And to be honest with you, I never would have gotten involved writing the Matthew Shepard story had I not been to UCross, because my first residency, I believe, it was at least 5 weeks, maybe six. And so there was just really a sense of place, of the landscape, that when I first heard about the Matthew Shepard tragedy, I just felt a connection to it right away just from having been at UCross.
You know, people don't really want to know the whole story once they've made up their minds about a crime or a situation. You wrote this book almost 15 years after Matthew Shepard was murdered and brought up things that I think angered people.
I think you're absolutely right. Although I wrote the book a number of years after the crime happened, my work on the case really began just a few months after the trials were over, after Aaron McKinney was convicted in early November 1999 and given two life sentences. I traveled to Laramie the first time to look into this case in February, just a few months after the trials. So that was really the beginning of my research into the case. And originally I went to Laramie to write a script for a made-for-television movie about the story as it had been universally reported by the media. And so, you know, I know that people, you know, had a very set view of what this case was about. But much of that was really determined by the national media. Once a story went out that this was, you know, a clear-cut anti-gay hate crime, you know, two strangers targeting someone because, you know, targeting Matthew because he was gay. Once that story went out, that became set in people's minds within days. However, it's important to just say that this was before police had really done an investigation and really looked into the motives behind the crime.
Your book really uncovers the incredible amount of drug usage and sales of drugs, meth particularly, that were a part of the crime. And you do such a beautiful job with the investigation. In fact, even though I knew the story, reading your book was this murder mystery that was just fascinating. But people didn't really want to think of the crime as a drug-related one. Is it because they didn't know?
Are you speaking, Corby, about people in the Laramie community, or do you think, or are you speaking about people in the country at large?
You know, that is a good question, because I thought, wouldn't Laramie want to be known not as a homophobic community? And if the drugs were exposed, they could say, this was not a hate crime. This was, you know, someone on meth. They knew each other. But that never really comes to light until your book.
It's true. The only time really I think there might have been maybe one or two news stories where meth was mentioned at the time very slightly. And then it was brought up in Aaron McKinney's trial. But remember, McKinney's trial was a year after the murder happened. But, you know, it's really complicated because this was really still at the front end, you know, in terms of the crisis in Wyoming. You know, it was really starting to get bad by 1998, but believe it or not, it got worse. By the early 2000s, this is when it was really kind of at its apex in terms of the number of meth-related crimes, many of them violent. But there was a period, and I, you know, mentioned this in the book, the prosecutor in the case said there was a period there where you could literally attribute 80% of the crimes in Wyoming to methamphetamine. At the time that this murder happened, many of the people that were in the jail where Aaron McKinney and Russell Henderson were there for meth-related crimes. But, you know, at this early stage, law enforcement, the police were just trying to figure out how to deal with this because it was clearly becoming a major problem. But there was also that, you know, at that early time, there was a lot of shame connected to it. People in the community didn't really want to acknowledge that this addiction was really starting to hit their community in this kind of way. So, you know, I think that there are many, many different kinds of people involved here, and people had different reasons for not wanting the truth to be told. Some of them were perhaps errors of omission, and I think there were people in other cases who deliberately worked to conceal the truth.
You know, another aspect of this that I didn't know until I 5 years ago, when a young gay friend of mine suffered a stroke after using meth, I didn't realize how prevalent meth was in the gay community. We're talking about not just the rural West, but particularly in the gay community. Why do you think so?
Well, I think there are a variety of things. First of all, when the meth crisis hit the gay community, it really began in a couple of big urban centers, L.A., New York, San Francisco. By the time of Matt's murder, it was a big problem in Denver. But, you know, crystal meth was being used because at the time, circuit parties were very popular, you know, kind of all-night dance parties. And meth is a drug that makes you feel all-powerful. When you take it, you feel like you can do anything. You're very awake and perky and you want to party. And, you know, and so it was sort of the right drug for the right time. But if I, you know, may say this, you know, the gay community was a demographic that was being marketed to, and this is coming from very powerful drug cartels. You know, you look at some of the other communities really affected by meth, Native American reservations. You think about the Wind River Reservation. I live in New Mexico part of the year on the Navajo Reservation. You know, these places were targeted, okay, for the sales opportunities that were there in a vulnerable population. And the same thing is true of the gay community. The gay community was a place that, you know, there had been certainly, you know, cocaine use prior, ecstasy, lots of other drugs. But the meth, you know, meth really infiltrated the gay community because someone saw it as a place, a good place to sell the drug. If I can just say this about some of my personal motivation for writing this story and for staying with it for a long time. I'm a survivor of the AIDS era. In the 1980s, I lost dozens of friends and colleagues, okay, who got sick very, very quickly and died. When I started to get educated about meth and learned about what it was doing to the community, and particularly that that there were higher rates of HIV transmission among crystal meth users, I was really concerned. I was horrified because I was really afraid that there was a second epidemic and that this drug could really cause devastation on a massive scale. And so part of the reason I stuck with it is I just, you know, coming out of the, let's call it, post-traumatic stress of the AIDS era, I just felt I cannot watch this happen to another generation of gay men.
I think it's interesting when we're talking about the gay community and you were mentioning all the night parties, Matthew Shepard was a charmer. I mean, he was a dancer. He was a pretty boy. He was a tease.
Yes.
I mean, the combination of that club scene in Denver was very attractive to him, and I think he was probably a very attractive character in that scene.
Without a doubt. I mean, from all the interviews I've done with friends of Matt, Matt was very sociable. You know, he really liked getting out. Even by the time he had moved to Laramie, he liked hiring a limousine, inviting friends, you know, to kind of party, go out, you know, to the Tornado Bar in Fort Collins. It was very interesting. I just did an interview a few days ago with someone who knew Matt in that Denver scene, the Denver party scene. And he had met Matt on three different occasions at different places. And so he actually took me to the locations in Capitol Hill in Denver just several days ago. And, you know, we combined my knowledge of places where the parties took place and his knowledge. And there was overlap because all of these places were within a few blocks in Capitol Hill. And it was a time when, it could be a mixture of young guys like Matthew and his friends. And sometimes you'd also have politicians and law enforcement people and clergy. And it was a very, very wild scene. And crystal meth was very much a part of that scene. In fact, the fellow that I was interviewing, you may know of him because his name is Mike Jones, and Mike outed the fundamentalist minister, Ted Haggard, some years ago. It was after Matt's murder. And Mike Jones knew Matt from that party scene in Denver before Matt moved to Laramie.
Steve, this book represents an immense amount of time and research spent. Given your very personal connections and passion to the storyline and your profession in journalism, how did those two things come together? Was it difficult to separate?
You know, that's a really great question, and it kind of, I guess I could unpack a few layers here. I mentioned earlier that I, you know, as a survivor of the AIDS era, I'm also a survivor of child sex abuse. I was abused between the ages of 10 and almost 14. And in the course of researching Matt's story, I discovered that Matt himself had been sexually abused as a boy. And I know of instances where he was abused by two different adult men. And so I began to understand something about why Matt turned to alcohol and drugs, that it wasn't just, you know, it wasn't just a matter of having fun, that there was also a way in which he was self-medicating. And so that was really of interest to me, having had the experience I did. It took me a really long time to be able to deal with that, to get the help I needed. I became politically active and worked in getting the law changed in New York, worked very closely with New York Governor Andrew Cuomo. And last year, after several years of work, we were able to pass the Child Victims Act in New York. So there was a piece of, you know, my motivation that had to do with, you know, we speak of coming out of the closet, is bringing that piece of Matt's story out of the closet. What is it? You know, that's part of his humanity, what he suffered from. You know, there are a number of other things. I would say that, like many Americans, I was losing faith in what was happening in journalism. I didn't set out to become a journalist. I was really working more in documentary filmmaking, writing screenplays, etc. But this took me on a detour into journalism. And when I saw how shoddy the reporting was around Matt Shepard's murder and how journalists were simply repeating what everyone else was saying in basically creating a myth. So when I really began to look at Matt's murder And I started to understand the confluence of forces that helped create a mythology within a few days. There were many forces. There were personal forces, friends of Matt, who helped, you know, put the story out. This crime happened literally within a week of an impeachment vote in the House against Bill Clinton in the Monica Lewinsky scandal. There were many things going on at the same time, but I was really taken. I was looking almost in disbelief. How could it be that so many news organizations, I mean, Laramie, you know, there were satellite trucks on the streets of Laramie. People were following people to their cars, knocking on their doors at home. How is it that a story like this one could be so misrepresented and certainly, if I don't say misreported, I would say underreported?
The other thing that I think is so interesting is how quickly politicians like Clinton and celebrities immediately responded to this horrendous crime, but called it a hate crime. And they never investigated the drug, the powers, the money that was involved with it. And in fact, at the time, I don't think there was a hate crime against gay and lesbian people in Wyoming. A hate crime had to be committed against a racial stereotype. Is that correct?
Well, again, so let's look at the context of what was going on in the country. The James Byrd killing had happened just a few months before in Jasper, Texas, a horrific crime that was clearly motivated by race. You also had, we were in the midst of a culture war. This was a period when, you know, certain conservative far-right Republicans were trying to sell conversion therapy, okay, to gay people. The Senate Majority Leader at the time, Trent Lott, referred to, you know, compared gay people to kleptomaniacs and alcoholics and said they should be, you know, they should treat themselves in a similar fashion. Pat Robertson, you know, homosexuality is the, you know, the last step in the decline of Gentile civilization. So you have a culture war going on. The James Byrd killing had happened. Bill Clinton is in the middle of impeachment. We've already had the Oklahoma City bombing. We've had Waco, these very, really violent events. So when this happened, you know, all eyes were on Laramie, including the Department of Justice, the FBI. There was concern, could Laramie explode in violence? People were receiving death threats, including the prosecutor in the case. While this case was going on, the prosecutor's two young sons they couldn't ride a school bus. And the prosecutor himself could only go to four or five places, and he was being, you know, watched all the time by federal agents because they were really afraid this could explode. So again, we have to look at the context and see why was this case such a flashpoint. If I could just go back to one thing about, you know, the way the media reported the story, there was one fundamental factual error that really has a lot to do with why the popular narrative took hold. And that is, it was believed that two guys, you know, and I'm saying here in quotation marks, you know, two, you know, homophobic rednecks walked into a bar and saw a guy who was well-dressed, who appeared to be gay, and they decided to target him because he was gay. The main thing that was missing is that Aaron McKinney, Matthew's killer, the one who beat him to death with a 357 Magnum, he and Matt had a relationship. They had been friends. They socialized together. So that's one fact that once you take that out of the equation, it changes everything. But at that moment, you know, if you believe that these two guys walked into a bar and targeted him because he was gay for a robbery, then you are. It appears to be a definitive hate crime. But if you bring in other motives and what was really going on that night, it changes the story completely.
I thought it was interesting. The character that I liked the least, okay, maybe Doc O'Connor might be the one I hated the most, but Aaron McKinney's girlfriend on the night after the crime came up with the idea that it was going to be an anti-gay crime, that somehow Matt had, you know, hit on these guys, and that's – she, you know, later told people, well, that's not true, but it was too late.
It was too late, and she did. This is Kristen Price. And, you know, in truth, it was in collusion with Aaron McKinney, because Aaron McKinney had gone home before Aaron McKinney was arrested, and they're trying to come up with an alibi here. Remember, Aaron McKinney, at the time, he was living with Kristen Price. This was his girlfriend. They had an infant child, and Aaron McKinney was a closeted bisexual. He had, you know, sex with other males for pleasure or for money, but he was closeted certainly to members of his family. And so Kristen knew some of Aaron's, you know, knew about some of Aaron's sexual behavior, but she stupidly thought that by trying to place the blame on the victim and say that Matthew made a sexual advance. In fact, Corby, the quote you're referring to is she said that Matt had come on to Aaron and Russell at the Fireside Lounge, had come on and made a sexual advance, and that they took him out to beat him up, to teach him a lesson not to come on to straight people. Now, first of all, Kristen Price was not there in the bar. And in McKinney's trial, you know, all of the witnesses that were there, many of them testified, and I interviewed many of the people, but that did not happen, okay? Matthew Shepard did not come on to Aaron McKinney at the bar and make a sexual advance, and that was not the motive behind the crime.
They had known each other for a very long time.
They had known each other for many months, actually. The crime happened in October of 1998. They had known each other at least from the year before, from 1997. But what I'd like to just say about Kristen Price is that in 2004, I produced a one-hour report for 2020 at ABC News. And Kristen Price, on camera, recants what she said, and we play the original video when she made that claim about, you know, a sexual advance on the part of Matt Shepard. And she just admits that she lied, and she said, I would have done anything to try to get Aaron out.
These are such sort of unreliable narrators, and all of the work to dig into these backstories. It's years of research that you have, and I understand that some of these sources are no longer with us, casualties of meth after the fact.
Yes. Well, this is one of the reasons why I decided to do the new edition. My publisher launched this year a new imprint called T2P, Truth to Power. And he asked me if we could do a new edition of Matt. And so, you know, obviously I was continuing to follow bits and pieces of the story with sources, but it gave me a reason to go back into it. So that's one of the things I write about, is the lasting legacies from this period where Laramie and much of Wyoming was going through a really horrible meth epidemic, that when I got back into the story and realized how many people have been affected by this drug crisis.
Stephen, would you be willing to read what you've added to the story? I know that you added a chapter, and we're talking about, you know, 15, 20 years later, you've discovered more information.
Yes. Well, I'd like to read you a short passage, and I'd like to give you the context of this passage. While Aaron McKinney and Russell Henderson were in jail awaiting trial for Matthew Shepard's murder, Russell Henderson's mother was picked up on a early January 1999, picked up on the street in Laramie by a man who, you know, he alleged later that he was going to give her a ride. He drove her out to a remote canyon outside Laramie, Rogers Canyon, took her to a place about 9 miles from Laramie, and he later acknowledged that he had raped her, had sex with her. You know, she wasn't consenting, And after they had sex, he pushed her out of the car and she froze to death by the side of the road. Her name was Cindy Dixon. And the man who did this, Dennis Menifee, fled. He was later arrested in Florida, but he received a sentence of 4 to 9 years, and he got out of prison in 4 years. So I'd like to just read you a passage because, you know, that night when Cindy Dixon took that ride with Dennis Menifee has really stayed embedded in my mind, I think, for reasons that will become clear from the passage. Mm-hmm. I have driven this winding two-lane county road on the north side of Laramie dozens of times since this book was first published. By day, the views are starkly beautiful. Rolling high desert prairie and rugged hills, a smattering of ranch-style houses and barns, and big Wyoming skies. The snowy range on the western horizon and the herds of antelope that roam free in these open spaces complete a picture that is soothingly pastoral. This wind-beaten land and the creatures living here momentarily restore my sense of balance and quiet hope, hope that we may yet pull through the ecocide and other emergencies looming before us, that we Americans will do much, much more to halt our headlong plunge toward the abyss of climate catastrophe. But when I drive Rogers Canyon Road alone at night, returning to my friend's home on a steep hillside near the mouth of the canyon, I replay a litany of obsessive thoughts about one of the mysterious killings that happened 2 decades ago. There is no way he drove her all the way out here with positive intentions, I tell myself reflexively. Just past the turnoff to my friend's long driveway, nearly 8 miles from Laramie, this curving paved road turns to dirt. My conviction is strongest on winter nights when the temperature has dropped below zero and a dusting of fresh snow whips across the prairie. If he was hungry for sex, or if they both were, this is the last place they would go for a tryst on a freezing January night. How could anyone believe the two were out for a casual late-night drive when things suddenly turned bad? By the time I park in my friend's gravel driveway and walk under a vault of stars to their back door, I'm all but certain the killer had a plan.
Steve Jimenez, what an immense body of work you have. It sounds like there is more work to be done. The Book of Matt, The Real Story of the Murder of Matthew Shepard, a new edition has just been released. Thank you, Steve, for being in the
studio. Thank you so much, Ann, and
thank you,
Corby. It's really a pleasure. It's been a pleasure being here.
Resounds, Arts and Culture on the High Plains is produced by Corby Skinner, Anna Page, and Ken Siebert for Yellowstone Public Radio. Theme music by Alex Naumann. Additional funding provided by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. More information on Resounds is available at ypradio.org.